Welcome to Risk Hedge Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan Roth, coming to you from Vancouver on the beautiful but cold west coast of Canada. My guest today is in Paris, France, a long way from the horrific and brutal prison cells he inhabited not that long ago. Theo Padnos is an American freelance journalist and author. In October 2012, after entering Syria from Turkey with the intention of reporting on the Syrian conflict, Theo was kidnapped by men posing as former Free Syrian Army fighters. He would go on to be held in various prisons operated by Syrian rebels with ties to Al-Qaeda and eventually the Sunni Islamist terrorist organization Al-Nusra Front. He was finally released from captivity in August of 2014, but came away with some very deep scars. A new film has been made about his story titled Theo Who Lived. In the accompanying article, you can see the trailer and find out more information about how you can view this documentary. Theo, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
First, Theo, why don't you tell me where it all began? Why were you in Syria and how did you get there?
In October of 2012, I was a struggling freelance reporter, which I still am, by the way. And I wanted to, I felt that since I had lived in Syria before in Damascus, from almost like 2007 to 2011, really, you know, for a period of years, I spoke Arabic, I studied the Quran there, I felt I understood the religious tensions that were underlying this conflict better than the other reporters who were writing in English. And I said, all right, you know, I have something to contribute here. And I know I'm not going to get paid very much. I mean, I knew I was going to make like just a few hundred dollars, but I didn't care. I wanted to, you know, shed light on this conflict and do something that I did, deploy the one skill that I had in life, which was analyzing this conflict. I felt I could do it well, and I could help us all understand what was really at stake and why we should care. And and it seemed to be getting worse and worse and worse. I was just intrigued by the whole thing, and I had sources on both sides, and I've always gotten along really well with Syrians. Like, they've always been so sweet to me, whether they're on the regime side or the rebel side. I mean, I was like, you know, they know I'm not a participant, so I'm not going to have any problems with these guys. And other reporters were going in, and they seemed to be having a nice time, and so off I went.
So had you been to the region before? What was, give
yeah,
me
course.
Some of the background of your experience.
Well,
in
I had, I started studying Arabic and Quran in Yemen in 2004. I stayed there in 2005, 2006. I was a reporter. I wrote a book about Yemen, and in 2007 I moved to Syria, and I studied Quran there, and in Damascus before all the trouble. And I never had anybody being in the least bit aggressive or hostile to me. You know, that people wanted to explain things to me, but nobody threatened me personally. I was in Syria, you know, at the very beginning of the violence in 2011, and then later I came back to the beginning of 2012, and at that point I could feel the society kind of falling in on itself, like collapsing. The social contract was clearly fraying, and people were, you know, you just felt this society is falling apart. But even then, it was the beginning of 2012. I'm like, they're not going to come get me. I went home that summer, and I came back in the fall, and I went into Syria in the fall of 2012. And that's when I got in trouble.
Okay, so you just said that's when you got in trouble. Spell out for me what actually happened to you. How were you actually taken?
And what actually happened is I met some seemingly nice young men who told me that they were like fixers for this Free Syrian Army or some kind of media. Like, you know, they helped set up journalists from the West with, I wanted to interview doctors, for instance. I was interested in a vanished American journalist called Austin Tice, and they told me they could take me to some of the villages this guy had been in. I was interested in the Westerners who were fighting on behalf of the rebels. So I said, can you take me to some of the brigades in which the Westerners are fighting? They said, no problem, no problem. To everything I said, they said, no problem. That should have been, you know, a red flag right there. There were many, many red flags that I did not pay attention to. I wanted to do my thing, and I felt I understood the situation. Well, clearly I didn't.
So, and this is on the Turkish side of the border, correct?
That's right. I mean, I met these people in Turkey, and they said, okay, sure, no problem. We'll take you down into Syria. You have a nice car, and we'll drive you around, and you can make all your interviews, and we'll drive you back in 2 days. So I got in the car with them. We ran through some olive groves. We got in another car on the Syrian side of the border. They drove me to a place called Jabal al-Zawiya, which is now like, it's a dangerous area in the northwestern part of Syria, which is now sort of under the control of Al-Qaeda. And anyway, we slept in an abandoned house the first night, my first night in Syria. And these guys did not, they were very distant and sort of cold with me, which Syrians never are. And they didn't eat with me, which is another bad sign. We drove through, we drove near some villages with that Islamic, the flag of the Islamic State. We drove like through these villages. At the entrance to these villages, there was that flag of the Islamic State that we know now as meaning ISIS. And at the time, it was fall of 2012. Well, it didn't mean ISIS. There was no ISIS, but it, you know, it was a spooky kind of thing. Which the car slowed down. They slowed down the car. They pointed this out to me. They go, "Can you read that sign?" I go, "Yeah." They go, "What does it say?" I said, "La ilaha illallah. There is no God but God." And they go, "Very good." And I kept going. You know, they showed me the handgun that they eventually used to, like, as they were carrying out their kidnapping operation. They showed me the handcuffs. They're like, there was all these signs I just did not put together because I wasn't in this mode of looking after myself. I was like, I'm a reporter. I need to analyze what's going on. I wasn't worried about myself. I was like, how can I better understand? You know?
So in retrospect, do you believe that these gentlemen, to put the term loosely, do you think that they were working directly for some sort of rebel group in Syria, or were they just business?
But I've seen these guys since on Facebook. You know, you can, they're all on Facebook. They're all on Twitter and Facebook. And the chief guy, yeah, he's clearly started out sort of as a rebel and then maybe worked with Jabhat al-Nusra. You can tell from his Facebook page. But eventually he ended up like ISIS thinking and psychology and supporting ISIS. You can tell very well exactly what kind of character this is by the stuff that he posts on Facebook.
You were accused of being a CIA spy. Why do you think that was?
I think any American who, really any American, but particularly one who can speak Arabic and has, I told them I had been in Yemen. Look, they were at the time, it was the fall of 2012, there were rumors circulating that the American army was soon going to come and just start invading Syria the way they had invaded Iraq. And they felt that I was an advanced sort of guard or spy or reconnoitering agent who was preparing the ground for a imminent American invasion. So they wanted to catch me and by mistreating me, send a message back to the Americans behind me that they shouldn't come because, you know, they told me this constantly. They shouldn't come because what was happening to me was going to happen to them 10 times as bad. They were constantly making videos, you know. It wasn't like we were doing this. They were when there was torture or electricity, or they put me like in a grave at one point, everything was filmed. And I'm sure it was filmed for the purpose of making some kind of, propaganda, James Foley type of video, which they never, thank God, they never got around to doing. But that's what seemed to be in their mind at the time. Like, we want to send a warning to America. Don't even think about it, basically. I can tell them when the American government comes, they do not come like I come with no weapons, you know, flip-flop sandals and, "Hey man, how are you?" is my attitude. They come with guns. They come with like helicopters and tanks. You know, I kept trying to tell them this. They didn't believe me.
So you just mentioned the name James Foley. Mm. What contact did you have with other Westerners while you were being held?
Well, in my prison, they eventually put another American in my prison cell. This wannabe freelance journalist guy called Matt Schreier. And he was the only non-combatant Westerner that I met. I met actual combatants from the West, but no No, non-combatant. He was clearly a non-combatant.
Right. What was your relationship like with him?
Hostile. He was like a confused young man. You know, war attracts really strange people, and this character had, he wasn't really a journalist, but he wanted to be a journalist. He had no connections with any newspapers or anything, had never done any journalism before, but he decided, I'll prove my mettle in Syria, and this will impress all the editors back home, and suddenly I'll be a famous photojournalist. And he was like, that was his fantasy, and look, war is the kind of environment that attracts people who are up for an adventure, and that's what he was interested in. And as soon as he found himself under adverse circumstances, he became very hostile and angry and aggressive, and I was like on the receiving end of just his rage. He was an angry character, so there was a lot of violence in our cell, and it was like, you know, you can't pick your cellmates, obviously. So
I guess you can't. Now, maybe, I mean, you just mentioned there was a lot of violence in your cell. Just psychologically, what do you go through once this starts happening? And I guess you might have had an advantage over a lot of other Westerners who had been held in Syria in that you understood and spoke Arabic. So you knew what was being said and talked about around you.
Right. I mean, that could be an advantage, but sometimes ignorance is bliss. It's like, if you don't know what they're talking about, you're happier. They make a lot of threats, and the threats don't affect you when you don't understand them. And they just describe horrible things that they're doing to other people, and you know that you can hear what they're doing, but when they tell you what they're going to do to you, it makes it worse. All right, your question is like the dynamics in our cell. Well, prison is in Syria anyway. It was a little like survivors of a shipwreck and a raft, and that we had very little food. We didn't know how long it was going to last, and we didn't trust each other to share the food properly. And we were like, we also were surrounded by sharks, and we were afraid that each prisoner, sometimes we're in a cell with like 30 people. So everybody in this, every one of these 30 people was afraid that one of the inmates was going to make a deal with a shark. Like, I will turn you over to the shark, you fellow prisoner, in exchange for my freedom. So we were terrified of each other. You know, this is the kind of environment that they create in a really stressful situation. We couldn't trust each other. And, you know, I think that the Syrians were pretty good to each other. Even they had some problems, though, but they were pretty good to each other. They stuck together. But the two Americans, man, we were at each other's throats.
Wow, that must have been, for you personally, I would assume, just trying to hold it together. It must have been very, very difficult, you know, going through this at the same time.
Yeah, you know, I was afraid of my fellow prisoners. I didn't know where I was going to get it from. You could get it from your fellow prisoners. You could get it from Jabhat al-Nusra. You could get it from the air. Like, they were bombing us from the air a lot, and they were shelling us from the air. So we could have died in so many different ways, and it was like, you know, choose your poison. But we didn't have a choice. You just had to sit in prison. You just have to sit and let it happen to you. Well, one thing that I am like, well, I'm I don't want to say proud, but my attitude was, I will not participate in any violence, because this violence is so what they're doing to us is so bad. I don't want to be like them. And a lot of the prisoners became a little like the guys that were imprisoning us. This happens in prisons. Like, the prisoners become a little bit like the guards to one another. There's a hierarchy within the cell, and I refused to participate in that, which made me like the weak guy in the cell, the guy that always gets picked on, but I didn't care. I mean, I'm like, I'm not going to be violent to another person. I still believe that. I would never, ever, you know, I would never do anything. I just cannot imagine a circumstance that would cause me to, perhaps there is a circumstance, you know, when your life is on the line, you have to fight for yourself. But my life would really have to be on the line. Like, I'm not going to sweat the little stuff. Never get in a traffic argument with anybody. If I do, I'm not going to be violent about it, and I'm not going to take it serious. I'll be like, all right, man, whatever. You know, this is what you learn in prison. Like, pick your battles and don't sweat the small stuff. That's something I took away from jail.
You did end up trying to escape a couple of times. What were those experiences like?
The first time it was those original kidnappers, the guy who I found on Facebook. I was handcuffed to that guy who eventually became like his crazy ISIS supporter, fanboy, maybe member. And I was handcuffed to him during the night, and he was like snoring really loudly. So I'm like, I gotta persuade this guy somehow to loosen up the handcuffs enough so I can slip out of them. So I kept going up. I kept asking to be released from the cuffs so I could go pee as he was sleeping. And he would take off the cuffs and then put me back in. And every time he put me back in the cuffs, I would say, oh, it's too tight, it's too tight, it's too tight. So one time he left it really loose, and as he was snoring, I slipped my hands out of the handcuffs and I ran away. I stood up, I walked over his sleeping body. There was another couple guys with Kalashnikovs and handguns, and I walked over them and I ran out into the dawn at the time, and I ran to the Free Syrian Army. I'm like, these are the moderate dudes, these are the good guys, help me. Of course, maybe some of them are moderate. I'm sure many of them are moderate. But these individuals that I ran into felt that I should be turned over to the court. So they brought me to the Islamic court, and the judge took one look at me. He's like, spy. And there was some formalities. There was a show of testifying. He had some witnesses. They were my kidnappers. In an Islamic court, you need two witnesses to constitute a prosecution. So these two kidnappers were the prosecution witnesses against me, and I was the defendant and my own witness on my behalf. And it was all in Arabic in this very a formal kind of Arabic that I'm not very good at. And it was kind of over my head. And before I knew it, I was condemned. But I didn't really know what for. Suddenly I was in jail. I was in a prison cell underground next to some Shiite Muslims that they had also imprisoned. So my advice for you is you don't ever be a defendant in the Islamic court, because you don't have a chance to defend yourself.
So you're saying that at least in legal matters, there seems to be this relationship between the Free Syrian Army and these other participants that are in the battle, the rebel groups like al-Nusra and others like them.
I think that depends from place to place. If you're interested in the relations between Jabhat al-Nusra or ISIS and the moderate rebels, I can discuss that. I don't think the courts in general, whenever they have a valuable asset, they don't take these things to court. And in fact, this court that I went to, it wasn't even a Jabhat al-Nusra court. The court turned me over to Jabhat al-Nusra. But basically, Jabhat al-Nusra controls everything. I mean, there's a pretense of control of the Free Syrian Army, but beneath this pretense is Jabhat al-Nusra. That's in the areas the rebel areas, the things we think of as the Free Syrian Army, it's all Jabhat al-Nusra. And in the ISIS areas, well, that's all ISIS. Yeah, it just happens that way because they have the popular support. They have the moral authority. They have the spiritual authority. They have the cash, and they have the guns. I mean, they are the powers. They are the power that is in Syria. And the U.S. government has this crazy notion that they can give weapons to the moderate dudes, and those weapons will stay in the moderate guy's hands. They will stay in the moderate guy's hands for 10 minutes, as long as Jabhat al-Nusra allows it to be that way. But the real power on the ground is Jabhat al-Nusra. It just is. They get the oil. They had the oil in, they have oil from the oil wells, in the east, and now, and they have, millions and millions of euros from the business of kidnapping and ransom, which is something the Free Syrian Army doesn't do as much. With the cash and the guns and the spiritual authority, they control the landscape. And if only I could have impressed this upon John Kerry or Samantha Power, we wouldn't have sent so many TOW missiles to them. But we did, in the belief that they were sweet and nice and would advance democracy. But really, all we were doing is advancing Al-Qaeda.
Well, and another thing that I think might have been useful for John Kerry to hear from you, as well as a lot of others, I've heard you say that for many of those who join al-Nusra or ISIS or groups like them, the jihad is actually fun. And that's not usually a term we associate with the war in Syria. How did you personally come to realize that there was this fun aspect to the jihad?
I mean, I lived with a young man who were having a wonderful time for 2 years. It's hard not to notice. It's like... these are young men that they didn't really have a whole lot going on in their lives. They were either university dropouts, they were like employees at grocery stores, or they were young men who were looking for the next big thing, and nothing was coming along, and nothing was likely to come along. Syria is a place where if your dad was a shoemaker, you're going to be a shoemaker. You know, it was that way for hundreds of years, and suddenly the revolution arrives, and you can be what they call an emir, which is, I think we translate that word as prince sometimes, but what it means is like a man of, you know, a man of riches and wealth and renown and accomplishment. And you can have a big gun, and you can have a pickup truck, and you can get married to more than one woman, by the way. So there's like a fantasy that appeals to young men. Tons of chicks, guns, cars, and cash that Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, they feed into this fantasy. Now, in real life, like the commanders will promise these young men, hey, oh yes, we'll get you married. We'll make sure that you have a car. We'll make sure you have a nice salary, blah, blah, blah. But in real life, you know, the beautiful things that the commanders are promising are always just around the corner, and they never give it to the soldiers. The soldiers are always like, hope, oh, tomorrow I'll get married, soon, next week. But it doesn't happen. These guys remain in a state of constant frustration, which, by the way, is just the way they were before the revolution. You know, it's a very failed revolution for the fighters themselves. They're not accomplishing what they want.
Taking that into account and realizing that there's this, as you say, there's this tension between the boots on the ground and the commanders and what's being promised and what's actually being delivered. What do you think is happening in Syria today that we in the West seem to be missing in terms of understanding this conflict and where it is going?
I'll tell you one big thing that's happening is that there's a second Islamic State that has emerged without the awareness, or, you know, nobody knows what is happening in the northwestern corner of Syria. Although I know because I'm in touch with some of these people and they're making videos all the time. We just haven't connected the dots. But yeah, there's a second Islamic State. It's right on the Turkish border. It has, like, to get to this second Islamic State from any European country, it's a couple of days on the bus, and young kids are going every day. That's what they tell me. That's what the guys on the ground in Syria tell me. Oh, yes, we have new French people, new English people every day. They're coming in there, you know, and we the journalists cannot go there, because if you go there, you will either get kidnapped or tortured or both, and nobody wants to risk it intelligently enough. I mean, the journalists are not that dumb. So they're not going. But, yeah, I mean, that's one important bit of news, is the existence of this second Islamic State. And what else is happening? I mean, the other thing is that the Syrian government gradually, by hook and by crook, is winning. And they are dispersing the rebels. The rebels have been concentrated in certain urban neighborhoods, and now they're going off into the countryside. They're occupying villages. And when the U.S. Army or the Kurds or some combination finally arrives in Raqqa, all those ISIS fighters, they will have been gone for weeks. You know, and they're out of town now. The U.S. is preparing, apparently, some kind of land invasion of the ISIS capital, Raqqa. But by the time the U.S. guys get there, there's not going to be a single ISIS dude anywhere nearby. I know this because I talked to them. They're not anywhere near there. You know, and all the big dudes are gone and have been gone for weeks already. Because, listen, this is an age-old Arab strategy. When the larger, more capable, more competent, more powerful army comes, you fade into the hills. They've been doing this for centuries, and they're going to do it again in 2 weeks when the Western armies or the proxy army arrives in Raqqa. They're still there, but they're just in camouflage in the background, and they're going to wait it out. That's what they do. That's what they did, by the way, when we went to Anbar province in Iraq. You know, ISIS emerged as soon as the U.S. government left in 2011. Okay, there was al-Qaeda in Iraq. Out of this al-Qaeda in Iraq thing came ISIS, and they know where to go when it's time to fade into the hills. So the reason why I'm saying this is because we must develop a strategy that is more powerful than their fade into the hill strategy. Otherwise, it'll be whack-a-mole forever. You know, we will go, we'll say, we're here, and then they'll go, fine. We don't care because, you know, we have faded into the background. We're civilians again. But as soon as we leave, they'll come back and they'll start cutting people's heads off and blowing things up and attacking the cafes in Paris. So ultimately, we want to negotiate. We want to better understand who these people are, what they want, and come to a kind of a peace with them. Otherwise, we will be killing them and they will be killing us until the end of time. We don't want this. So, you know, if it sounds like I'm advocating for peace with ISIS, well, I am. I mean, There's too many of them to kill. And there are a lot of them that are children. You know, we can't kill these kids. We have to understand who they are and give them something of what they want. By the way, they will negotiate with you. I negotiate with them every day for like 2 years. You can negotiate with them. There's stuff that they want. Well, let's give it to them. They all want iPhones. I'm not saying we should give them all iPhones. Well, actually, maybe we should, but I mean, there's stuff that they want. So we have to like pacify them somehow. So we got to give them some stuff that they want. We got to start talking to them, you know. For the reason why they killed Kayla Mueller, for instance, is because we refused to talk to them. We would not pick up the phone. And this beautiful young woman, so promising, so full of life, and so expressive of the good side of American culture, we let her die for no good reason that I could see, simply because we refused to pick up the phone. So my feeling is, yeah, we got to pick up the phone and talk to these guys.
All right. I guess a final question for you then is, to what degree, and this is all with the backdrop of what you just told me, to what degree is the conflict in Syria and the broader Middle East, to what degree is this a military conflict, a political conflict, and then really a theological conflict within Islam? Because those narratives are all, you know, they're very difficult, I think, for us in the West to kind of understand,
right, to sort out
what's happening. Right.
Yeah, I mean, you could say it's also a financial conflict. Perhaps at the bottom of everything is the fact that there's a bunch of people who feel that their birthright, namely their oil and their natural resources, has been robbed from them by these multinational companies and their own government, and they want to come at the employees of the companies, at all the well-to-do people, and take that wealth that they feel has been robbed from them back. To me, that's the most powerful driver, is the deep economic equality that exists in Syria. You know, it's a society with a tiny, tiny caste of very, very rich people, billionaires, and then millions of people that do not have two pennies to rub together. You know, they can't feed their families, and they have enormous families. So I think the key to me to begin to resolve the conflict is to address this economic inequality and to provide jobs and infrastructure and schools and, you know, hope, economic hope for the millions of people that have none today. And I think if we get that in order, all these theological issues will sort themselves out. They will turn out to be the trivia that they really are. You know, if you ask a bunch of ISIS fighters, like, hey, man, what is the real difference between the Alawites, theologically speaking, and you guys? They come up with a few, a few theological points, but they change the subject within like 30 seconds because they don't know and really they don't care. In other words, what I'm saying is this is a pretend theological conflict, and beneath it, there are other issues.
Great insight, Theo. I really, really appreciate your time and wish you all the best.
Okay, thank you very much.
For Risk Hedge Radio, I'm Jonathan Roth.